RehabCast, the official podcast of ACRM and the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, is sponsored in part by Shepherd Center.
My name is Zach Bradley. I'm a current employee and former patient of Shepherd Center, which specializes in medical treatment, research, and rehabilitation for people with spinal cord injury, brain injury, stroke, multiple sclerosis, spine and chronic pain, and other neuromuscular conditions. Our specialized clinicians serve as complex care partners. They collaborate with medical professionals who refer their patients to Shepherd Center to help them achieve optimal outcomes, returning them to their homes, communities, schools, and workplaces.
Learn more at shepherd.org.
Welcome to the 40th episode of RehabCast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. I'm your host, Dr. Ford Vox of the Shepherd Center in Atlanta. In this podcast, we'll be learning from Tiago Jesus of Northwestern University and Christina Papadimitriou of Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan, on their work elucidating the person-centered rehabilitation model, which is really a theme we see in the journal over recent years and also featured in this podcast before. Then we're going to delve into fascinating work at Santa Clara Valley Medical Center linking cognitive profiles to psychological well-being following spinal cord injury. Joining us now on the RehabCast, we have two guests, both co-authors on a paper entitled The Person-Centered Rehabilitation Model, Framing the Concept and Practice of Person-Centered Adult Physical Rehabilitation, based on a scoping review and a thematic analysis of the literature. To discuss this with us, we have Dr. Tiago Jesus, who is a postdoctoral scholar in global health and tropical medicine at the University of Lisbon. And we also have Dr. Christina Papadimitriou, who is associate professor at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
I know this work, like a lot of them, has been a long time coming. And there's a paper dating back to 2016 outlining this plan in BMJ Open at that time. The concept, as I understand it, you guys certainly need to tell me, is there's a lot of lingo being bandied about and efforts in incorporating the patient, i.e. the person, although there's some distinguishing characteristics between the two, and you guys prefer person-centered, and we'll learn about why that is, and a lot of different efforts in putting the person slash patient where they should be at the center of the rehabilitation model, but people coming at it in different directions and maybe defining this concept in slightly different ways. And I gather your hope is to help settle and classify this issue some more. Tell us about the background. Is that generally correct? Where do these ideas start to bubble up from, kind of back in prehistory to where we are now, and now this effort in kind of delineating this? Tiago, if I could have you start with that question.
Yes, I can start with the answer to that question. Everyone talks about the patient-centeredness or person-centeredness or the needs to deliver rehabilitation, healthcare in general, or rehabilitation care in particular, through a person's patient or person-centered approach. And everyone might have a wrong idea or a wrong understanding of what that means, and everyone is eventually tasked to do that in a certain way or to promote it in a certain way. But we eventually came to conclude that everyone speaks about it, everyone requires, but no one exactly determined what does it mean, either in concept or in practice. The actual title of the protocol uses this expression, what exactly does it mean to be person-centered in concept and practice? And that was the challenge that we were facing 5 years ago. And it was a long road to come to this final product and comprehensively reviewing the literature to come to an understanding of what would person-centered rehabilitation entails in both practice and risk and in concept. And it was this particular challenge to bring those issues together, the concept of the practice but also important to do so because the practice illustrates the concepts, and the literature that we have reviewed provide illustrative examples of that illustration of those practices. And it was very important, although complex, to combine both the concept and the practice in the same paper. And that was the challenge. And one interesting issue is that Christina was not the initial set of authors which designed this, but that's a very interesting issue about publishing protocols. It's that Christina saw our protocol, reached out with the corresponding authors. We understand that there was a lot of common interests about developing this and important skills to be brought in. And that's it's a vivid example of how to publish, for example, a study protocol can bring eventually someone on board for enabling doing this important work.
Definitely. Well, Christina, that's fascinating. So tell us about what drew you to this project so strongly. And would you couch this project in any other slightly different context in terms of its overall importance or role in the rehabilitation sphere?
Sure. So a lot of questions you just posed. So let me see what the best way to respond to them. When I read the scoping review that Tiago and his team at the time put out, it was very attractive to me to understand and to be part of this work because I understand myself as a scholar and a researcher who is interested in making rehabilitation medicine more person-centered. I have a humanistic interest in making that possible. And so I have worked with CARF International and Chris McDonald in particular to try to understand what we called at the time client-centered practices in rehab, because in the early 2000s, that was the expression. That's what we used. So, and as you know, CARF International is very interested in putting the person served in the center. So to me, reaching out to Tiago and his team was a very natural thing to do because it fuels the passion that I have to work in this area of person-centeredness. And what does it mean for rehabilitation? Mm-hmm. To pivot back to a question you asked earlier about person versus patient, I'm a sociologist by training.
Oh, really? Okay.
The word patient to me and throughout my training is a fairly passive word. It's a word that doesn't really give a lot of agency to the human who is at the center of care. With my interaction with CARF and their conceptual use of the words person served, and then the literature has been moving forward in this area, you understand, since the 60s, and there is a general dissatisfaction with using the word patient, though in the medical field, patient is still the preferred term.
It's already changing. Right. New reports already, even from the medical field, has been replacing the term patient-centered from the term person-centered, just to acknowledge there is a person behind the patient. There is a lot more in that person. It's the singularities of the person, a unique personality, preferences, and so on, that goes beyond the patient needs to be respected and addressed by the approach. And that's why the term person-centered was preferred. And we had some discussions and we had some evolutions on the framing up to the terminology that pleases us all. And for sure, this term person, it's a term that we repeated a lot of time in our paper. And even the first category that we provide, the first attributes, the person professional, it's essentially around the issues of respecting the person beyond the patient and being person-centered. It's more than individualizing care plans to the patient. It's looking for tailoring the whole interactional approach that we have to the personality that is in front of us, the values, the meanings, etc. That goes way beyond the unique patient. The unique patient, there is a unique person.
Yeah, these titles that we give each other that we use in healthcare and all different fields of life, I suppose, even our personal lives, I mean, they carry with them a lot of deeper meaning and expectations or baggage seemingly associated with it. You label someone a patient, well, you're expected to be in the patient role, to kind of live up to the expectations of what it means to be a patient. Like you have a certain role to play in this interaction, you know, the provider, you know, has another role. Obviously, there's a lot of, you know, physicians and other folks in healthcare prefer not to use that term provider. We don't want to be called by our individual profession, whether it be occupational therapist or physician or so forth. But there's, you know, these terms that we use for each other perhaps box people in. Maybe there's some aspects of that fulfilling a professional role or duty that are important to be precise. Maybe when it comes to something as complicated as a new onset disability and its rehabilitation of what it means for you as a whole person, maybe that box is too confining.
Yes, and the beauty about calling something a person-centered model is that the word person, at least as we have been looking into the literature and as we have been developing this model, involves the significant others and involves the caretakers and the caregivers or the care partners. So that is, as you see in our model, we focus on the three different levels, the dyad, but also the meso level and then the macro level, because it's very important to understand the dyad or, right, the provider-person interaction, and then the teamwork, and then the organizational piece, and all of that works together. When you only speak of a patient, it's as if they are in sort of some kind of vacuum all on their own. Nobody lives in a vacuum all on their own.
And also to reinforce that diet, that both the provider and the person contribute to that diet, and there is a relationship that is construed at their interaction and not only at the roles of the provider or the role of the patient. There is a diet and a partnership. There is established and a relationship that person-centeredness it's about, as well as then the team conditions and the organizational conditions for that to happen. We indeed include all those dimensions in the model because they really need to be, as we frame, addressed somehow at the same time, because these elements interact with one another and it's way more difficult to try to be person-centered at the diet if the team does not work in a person-centered way, or if the organization it's not designed or it's not designing its processes for care to be person-centered. And that's why we think that this model could be very useful for quality improvement projects, because it can address different levels that impact the delivery of person-centeredness, and both at the DIAD level, at the team level, at the same service organizational level, and quality improvement activities can address each one of those elements and sometimes combine them in meaningful interventions. And that's one of the uses that we think this model can be a resource for helping those leading quality improvement activities in the rehabilitation field, trying to have in this model the concept and examples of practice that they can involve, but also all attributes combined with a meaningful way to try to understand the relationships among them.
Do you all think there's something unique about the rehabilitation field and how important it is to have this form of conceptual thinking about the person-centered model, given how participatory it is for the person, the rehabilitatee, actively participating and doing the rehabilitation versus, say, I mean, frankly, there are some other more transactional forms of medicine out there that we all know and use and are perfectly useful and so forth. I don't know to what extent this rubric is that important. I mean, you have sudden appendicitis, go in, get your appendix out, technical procedure, do well, just fine. I mean, I don't know what it matters how your surgeon interacts with you in that process or so forth. You got a rash, a dermatologist looks at it, maybe puts it on a microscope or not, gives you the correct salve, your rash improves. I mean, it's just, you know, there's kind of technical, transactional type medicine, but rehab is a little bit different.
I guess that we understand that person-centered rehabilitation can be understood as the own rehabilitation. Is there any other way to eventually doing it? Because it can be in the very essence of what is rehabilitation, of engaging a person. And we address that in our model. We have attributes focused on meanings and eventual life goals before rehabilitation goals being addressed. So, and rehabilitation goals are instrumental for the person to eventually reacquire a life that it's meaningful to it. And most of our encouragement there, it's related with that. It's trying to find a meaning and provide hope or a meaningful future. It is as much as as related to person-centered rehabilitation as it is for rehabilitation overall, as eventually it could be framed. So this is probably not a specific feature of rehabilitation, but eventually something that it's probably entailed or required in the own framing of rehabilitation, and more, and probably more so than in other healthcare fields, even though this is required in healthcare fields overall. As a practitioner, I'm a clinician. I was an occupational therapist for over a decade, in addition to having also some training or doctoral training in health psychology. And really, our practice needs to embed this element, not as an additional feature or something that it's nice to have, but something that it's eventually part of the very definition of rehabilitation practitioner. And trying to define that it's not just a side thing or a nice feature to include in rehabilitation, it's probably in the very essence of rehabilitation. Mm-hmm.
So physical medicine and rehabilitation is a very, on some level, very heterogeneous practice in the sense that it incorporates a lot of different kinds of populations, right? There's so many people who are going to see a physiatrist who are going to need rehabilitation services. So it's hard to sort of speak at what is the core of rehab sometimes. From my point of view, it is about habilitating. It is about understanding the person who comes to you, who needs your services, who they are, what they have been through, what are the things that define them, and what are the needs, right, for the kinds of services they're looking for. So what are their habits? What were their habits? And what kinds of new habits can we in rehabilitation create, recreate, maintain, adjust, adapt, let go of, and how do we forge that life forward, whether that is because of an injury or an acquired disability, or whether we're speaking about chronic illnesses that, of course, have different trajectories and milestones and changes and differences as we age. So if the goal is to habilitate, that by definition means that we have to understand who this person is, and what their relationships in the world are, and how they understand themselves, their bodies, their abilities, their wishes, their desires, their hopes. So yes, even in rehabilitation, there'll be tasks to do, right? But unlike some of the examples you gave from a more acute care environment, in rehabilitation, unless you understand what is meaningful to the person and to the caregiver, I think you're missing the boat. I think you're missing a chance to really impact people. And the whole thing about rehab is that we are impacting people, and it's not from 3 to 4 on a Wednesday and I don't see you again for a year, right? There is chronicity. There is a difference there.
But yeah, because life itself is the goal, you know, to go on living.
Living well, right? We are now in a position to talk about living well and about well-being. Yeah. And so that's part, in my view, in the approach to doing things. So the other piece that I think is important about rehabilitation, it's yes, rehabilitation needs to and should focus on outcomes, right? On measurable things that we can see and show and prove that we have done to get people to be better. But it's also a process, right? So there is a process and outcome focus that we have to think about. And part of what we have tried to also do in this model is to make explicit both the conceptual and the practical, but we have been very careful not to create some kind of recipe by which people are then going to just take this model and say, oh, let's plug it in into whatever hospital in whatever part of the world, and it's all going to work out. Part of the goal of presenting this model is to say, here are the principles, as Tiago mentioned, here are the principles and the attributes of what we think makes for person-centered rehab. But we're not giving you, we're giving you sort of a general roadmap. We're not giving you sort of an, if you do the following 10 things, you're good to go, right?
Yeah. I guess that I can add that this model intends to guide, not to dictate. And one of the elements of the guide, it's one of the attributes of being person-centered, and that we have one attribute for that, it's to be adaptive, it's to be reflective, it's to adjust the approach for that particular person that is in front of you, to be attentive to the emotional cues that you have. So by the own definition of being person-centered, we could not provide a full recipe for doing that, because by the own definition, there are different persons in which different approach would work differently. And we need to really adjust our approach and to learn over the course of the interaction with that approach. And that's something that reputation has. It's not a one-off consultation, and we need to really adjust and to try to understand what works best for that person, not only in terms of care, but only in terms of the communication, the interactional approach, whether the person wants to be known deeply or whether the person wants to be participating in care decisions, in the daily day-to-day decisions, or just in the rehabilitation goals or setting rehabilitation goals, or just want to have a nice chat while an informal chat while the treatment is delivered. And none of that can work under a unique recipe. And we just try to provide the attributes for that. And one of the attributes is that it's the capacity to be adaptable to the person in front of you. And that's probably the most challenging aspect of delivering person-centered rehabilitation. And probably also one of the most interesting, because it's subject to failure. You need to be very attentive to the person that you have in front of you beyond the computer screen to deliver a person-centered care approach. And we cannot, as researchers, think that we can provide a full recipe for, we can provide guidance, we can provide illustrative examples of the literature. We can show something that has worked in certain conditions, but we can provide a model that fully dictates what you need to do at each step, each timing or in at each situation, because part of the definition is to be adapted to the person, not the excessively guiding guideline.
Did y'all come across any kind of case studies, or do you think that would be, if they don't exist, is that a good way to perhaps communicate kind of what we're talking about here? Like, you know, here is kind of the cookie cutter approach to rehabilitating this problem. Here is how it changes and adapts, utilizing this person-centered, kind of more interactive, next-level approach. And kind of vignettes, that type of thing.
Being technically proficient and being highly skilled in the evidence that exists, it's also important for a person-centered approach, because you want to provide patients with options and alternatives and et cetera. We need to know about those alternatives and what has worked in science, but you can't apply directly to it's more than effective care. It's what they now call appropriate care. Whether different levels of effectiveness, or what was once called the evidence-based medicine or approach, can really fit that particular person, and that needs to be learned at each time with each unique individual. It needs to create a diet, as we mentioned. And both should come to relevant conclusions in both regarding the rehabilitation pathway to follow. And currently, we don't see this world of person-centered care or evidence-based care as two worlds apart, but two worlds that contribute to wonderful care. We need to know about the effectiveness. You need to be technically proficient, and using a person-centered approach to deliver that, it's a wonderful way to put it.
Christina, were there cases, or are you aware, I mean, with everything you guys look through, where folks seem to be kind of, or are you generally aware that folks are utilizing perhaps some of this lingo, talking the talk but not walking the walk, in person-centered care? Are there kind of examples of that, or where people seem to be kind of talking past the problem? But because I understand this is part of your goal to kind of put some meat on the bones here and describe exactly what this could and should be, how it actually influences your care delivery, maybe even your model of exactly how you're structuring your inpatient and outpatient programming and so forth, versus kind of just some window dressing that makes it look as if you're kind of incorporating more of the individual direction than you really are.
This is a terrific question, and it's difficult to answer exactly but I'll do my best. And my answer to you in this moment is to say that in my experience of reading the literature and doing actual empirical collection of data from different kinds of rehabilitation environments and settings, I have found the general to be the case that rehabilitation practitioners believe deeply that they are doing person-centered care. However, the devil is in the details, if that's an allowable expression in our days. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. We don't have very good tools to measure person-centered care. We don't have very good tools to figure out how to implement person-centered care. And so there are multiple flavors, which is okay. And there's multiple ways in which people do things, which is okay, because they are adaptive to environments. However, people often in rehab, who work in rehab, come to, well, we're doing it already. What are you talking about? And so there is a little bit of resistance, therefore, for papers like the ones we are bringing forth, or for the kind of work that we're trying to do at the practical practice and conceptual level, because people think they are already doing it, but I don't think they're already doing it, or they're not.
Some of the literature that gave rise to this was an empirical literature, was that practitioners are rating their practice as more person-centered than their patients or care recipients who are dealing.
Correct. The patients are not always content with some pieces of their care.
Even though practitioners believe they are delivering such an approach, their patients, or in this case, the person-centered, don't really think that's the case. And really, one of the things that was extracted was that to really change the scenario, we need to challenge the assumption that we, and I'll use a collective we, are already person-centered as much as we could be. And for any improvements to occur, we need to step away from that assumption. And eventually the idea is that because it's adapted, it's very complex to achieve. We are never quite there. You can be closer to there, but you are never quite there. And to assume that we are not quite there, it's probably the first thing to done for an improvement to occur. If you believe that you are already person-centered, you are not going to develop any improvement activity to adapt. But the first problem is, okay, but what is it?
Yes.
Person-centered care. Yeah. And that's what we're trying to address in this work, because we believe we are a thing that you are unable to define. So it's very difficult to deconstruct all this assumption without first really defining what it is. And after defining what it is, it's probably more certain for we to look at the whole model and say, well, we don't do all this stuff perfectly every day down the road.
Yeah, I have to remain and working with people. That's part of what makes it interesting. I mean, this is not software. There's not a factory
that's
making
human.
Widgets.
That's human interaction.
It's human interaction.
It's never. Yeah. We are not perfect every day of our lives, and certainly not in our practice. So it is subject to failure, to continuous learning. And one of the categories addressed this issue, we need to retrospectively look at our practice, trying to learn from that, what went wrong, what could have been better. If you assume that we are already doing it perfectly, it's really the first thing to be challenged.
But it's important to remember, it's not just the practitioner. Right. But it's also the environment within which it takes place. So in many places that may be seen or are actively doing, as Tiago mentioned earlier, quality improvement, it's the idea is also what kinds of systems, right, are not working, what kinds of practices that are larger than an individual practitioner are working or not working. So being person-centered means being also provider-centric, right? Are we providing are we offering trainings and education to providers? Are we creating systems of support for providers so that they can be person-centered? Is the organization, the institution within which all of this work takes place, is it creating an atmosphere, a culture of person-centeredness? So all of these pieces are important. Tiago and I feel passionate about making sure that, I think that's true, Tiago, if I speak for both of us, that we feel it's important that we understand person-centeredness, not to be just in the hands of the provider, the individual practitioner. That's why our model, right, creates the sort of the concentric circles that are working to understand the context within which it all is relevant.
And I guess that's quite right. And making a bridge eventually to the future, this is not a one-off for sure product. It's probably the first step in a long road to use person-centeredness as an element for improvement. And it also involves organizations. And interesting that for the future, for the project I'm starting now, it's exactly trying to building the organizational conditions for quality improvement activities on person-centered care to occur systematically and for providing all the organizational characteristics and processes and structure for that to happen in a regular basis. So it's not only for the frontline staff, it's a responsibility for frontline staff, for managers, for healthcare leaders and organizations, and for researchers as well to support that process and to do it at the multiple levels that we have identified in our model.
Well, Tiago, Christina, we could go on talking about this for some time. It is fascinating work. And as you mentioned, organizations are going to be important, maybe even accrediting organizations. I know one of you, for example, has worked with CARF before as well. I could see that organization, others kind of look rating folks the degree to which they are really person-centered and so forth. It sounds like both of you could perhaps even serve as program consultants to a certain extent in this regard. I encourage everyone to read the paper in the journal. It offers great detail, and I think there's a lot to learn, and it sounds like there's going to be more coming out from both of you in the future in this regard, and I hope to see it in the pages of Archives of PM&R. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Joining us now on the Rehab Cast, we have Dr. Elizabeth Paspanojcha. Dr. Paspanojcha is Clinical Research Program Manager at the Santa Clara Valley Medical Center. She and her colleagues there have authored original research in the Archives of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation on cognitive profiles among individuals with spinal cord injuries, predictors and relations with psychological well-being. Dr. Paspanojcha, thanks for joining us in the Rehab Cast today.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
All right. Well, this is definitely in the category of big, important questions to be asked. As you point out right at the outset, generally understood that there's a fair amount of some neuropsychological impairment seen in the SCI population. I think a lot of us perhaps believe that to be perhaps related to these traumatic injuries and the coincident traumatic brain injuries and so forth. Regardless of the etiology, we know it's important, and your study is kind of starting to dig into just how important that is. Where did you and your colleagues come up with the idea for this study and designing it this way?
So several years ago, Dr. Kazuko Shem, who's an SCI physician and the senior author on this work, she became interested in investigating rates of concomitant TBI among individuals who have spinal cord injury during acute rehab. In her clinical experience, cognitive impairment was relatively common, but often undiagnosed and untreated because SCI tended to be the more emergent medical concern during acute rehab. And so she began this moderately sized research study that enrolled 92 individuals who had both traumatic and non-traumatic spinal cord injury during acute rehab to look at cognitive impairment. And when the work first started, we expected that individuals who have traumatic spinal cord injury would have greater cognitive impairment than those with non-traumatic spinal cord injury. And this assumption was because external forces that lead to spinal cord injury can often lead to a TBI and higher rates of cognitive impairment. But when we looked at the data, the supposition wasn't really quite what we thought it would be because there was evidence of cognitive impairment regardless of whether people had a traumatic or non-traumatic spinal cord injury. And so this motivated looking at the data a bit differently. and thinking that cognitive impairment might not fall cleanly along the lines of traumatic versus non-traumatic injury. And the literature actually does suggest that a substantial number of people who have non-traumatic SCI and no history of TBI have cognitive impairment. And so some of the reasons for this might be because of pathophysiological reasons like inflammation, secondary complications that might occur following spinal cord injury, might be hypoxia or neuroatrophy of the brain following SCI.
Or perhaps just the incredible stress of the event, too, one wonders. You know, it's fascinating because there's been a distinction in the literature for some time between kind of dual diagnosis, spinal cord and traumatic brain injury versus kind of regular old either one, TBI or spinal cord injury, but generally more in reference to SCI. And generally recognize that folks with an official dual diagnosis, like, you know, perhaps imaging findings and TBI, or at least coming into the rehab center with that diagnosis as well, that, you know, this rehab is going to take a bit longer. The outcomes might not be quite as good and so forth. But you know, you can be dual diagnosis and non-traumatic as well. I guess, you know, with the magnitude of the various medical events that are causing spinal cord injuries, oftentimes secondarily to big systemic illnesses and sepsises and so forth. These are generally resulting a lot of CNS stress generally, it appears.
Yeah, and they may also be treatment-related factors. So it may be the medications, or it could be pain and poor sleep contributing to cognitive impairment or lower cognitive functioning within the context of acute rehab. So there are multiple reasons that individuals who have acute spinal cord injury might be exhibiting poor cognitive functioning at the time. So one of the things that we began to consider in looking at this mixed group of individuals who have these different injury etiologies is that there may be unobserved or latent subgroups of individuals who have different levels of cognitive functioning. And so we used a technique called latent profile analysis. And this is analogous to latent class analysis, except the types of indicators that you use don't have to be dichotomous. They can also be continuously measured. So we used latent profile analysis to identify individuals with different patterns of cognitive functioning based off of their scores on the measured cognitive variables. So latent profile analysis, like latent class analysis, can pass out the heterogeneity and identify the latent subgroups of individuals who share similar features. And so we were motivated then to look and see within these individuals with acute spinal cord injuries whether there were specific patterns of cognitive functioning, and then also to relate the patterns of cognitive functioning to psychological well-being later on, 6 months after the study, when they're home and back in their setting.
So at the 6 month mark, the PHQ-9 was done, but R bands was not done again. That was just in the original.
We'd intended on collecting the R bands as well afterwards. So we have these two time points to see whether there's any change, but it was difficult to get individuals to come back.
Sure.
And so we only really had the self-report measures of PHQ-9 and life satisfaction.
Makes sense. Okay.
And with these profiles, we were also interested in examining whether there were any injury-related characteristics that might be associated with being in a class of individuals with better or worse cognitive functioning. And so we examined covariates of cognitive functioning in these latent classes. And what we found was that there were three classes of individuals with differential patterns of cognitive functioning. So the majority of individuals actually had good or intact cognitive functioning. So that was about 54% of the study participants. But there was also a considerable group of individuals who had delayed memory impairment, and another class of individuals who had impaired cognition across multiple domains. And just for ease of referencing these classes, we called the class of individuals who had no cognitive impairment class one, the class of individuals who had delayed cognitive functioning or late memory impairment class two, and then the class of individuals who were impaired across multiple domains class three. And we found that when we look at the pre-injury characteristics, individuals with high school education or less, history of substance use, history of smoking, and also those who had greater post-concussive complaints during the acute rehab were more likely to be classified in that class three, or the class of individuals with impaired cognitive functioning across the board, compared to being in class one, so having normal cognitive functioning.
Out of curiosity, I didn't see it in there, but was there any discussion or consideration of asking folks whether they were involved in any type of litigation related to their spinal cord injury? I know there's a large body of prior research suggesting that that can potentially affect some subjective outcomes.
That's a good point. No, we didn't ask or collect data on whether there were any pending litigations or if they had workers' comp paying for acute rehab. In general, because they knew this was study-related and not related to the care that they were receiving or wouldn't be related to any benefits they might receive outside of the study, we imagine that most people would not have that as a motivation to alter either their responses on the self-report or to deliberately change their pattern, what we might see on the RNs. Yeah. But that is a possibility.
Another interesting thing to consider that, I guess could be asked if we had that second R bands as well. If there were some folks whose R band scores significantly improved, like got them from three back into the one category or something like that, if those folks still had perceived generally worse outcomes, you wonder if maybe they needed more time on the front end and could have had a better outcome, like didn't achieve as much in their early rehabilitation, because maybe that, they have some neuropsychological impairment. It's not gone to improve with time, but that would be one interesting question to ask. Or conversely, if the R bands, was getting worse over time, and how that might influence what people's outcomes were. I mean, it's expected to be potentially fluctuating a little bit more so in the other direction, I would think, from directly hospitalization, acute medical event, trauma, and so forth, and then might improve a bit over time, but improve better for some people versus others. Mm-hmm. You know, more normally what you might expect is perhaps the subpopulation of folks whose R bands went on to improve maybe would be those amongst the group reporting better outcomes, maybe. But
yeah, no, that's definitely a consideration, that there would be some individuals who would have resolution of some of the symptoms or complaints that they were experiencing post-quarantine to injury. And then as they go home, they gain better functioning across multiple domains. And unfortunately, we aren't able to examine in this study what patterns of cognitive functioning look like over time. Yes, some people who might stay stable, some people who might improve, and maybe some people who decline. Those would be really interesting questions to look at and try and elucidate in future work. We do know that from other studies, though, that cognitive impairment isn't just a feature of acute spinal cord injury. Even in the chronic phase of injury, the rates of cognitive impairment remain high. So variable estimates suggest cognitive impairment may be up to 60% across both acute and chronic SCI. And there's one study that looked at individuals with chronic SCI, and they found that individuals with chronic spinal cord injury had about 13 times greater rates of cognitive impairment than matched controls. And looking at a very long view, there may be cognitive impairment might be a proclivity for other types of impairment later on, like dementia. So there are studies that are beginning to look at higher rates of dementia among individuals with spinal cord injury. So there are definitely some vulnerabilities to cognitive well-being, both acutely as well as very long-term among individuals with SCI.
Other practical considerations of these findings, which generally showing this class three group reporting worse outcomes on that PHQ-9, would be the importance of doing, right? Universally, although you discuss, it might not seem practical to do universally, but some neuropsychological screening for folks. And one wonders if it's even important to do, you know, on the front end at the time of referral to rehabilitation in order to perhaps get a longer length of stay, you know, discussing with various payers and so forth. This case is going to take a little bit longer. It's going to take longer for them to learn and to do the rehabilitation, and, you know, significantly higher risk of a worse outcome here and so forth. That certainly comes to mind.
Yeah, no, definitely. It would be ideal if there were more broad screening of cognitive functioning and also psychological well-being within acute hospitalization to try and limit the effects that these concerns might have on functioning when people go back home. There are definitely a lot of new skills and knowledge that have to be acquired during hospitalization to limit complications and improve functioning. And if individuals who might be at risk for poorer outcomes can be identified sooner, they can get more targeted interventions, and then hopefully set them up for doing better when they leave the hospital.
Well, important work, fascinating, particularly for me with regards to kind of, I just feel like it explodes a little bit, this whole, idea of the major significance of this special category or subcategory of dual diagnosis to a certain extent, given how broad this problem is in the spinal cord injury population. This study certainly reinforces that. To the reader, and definitely everyone working with this population, be well attuned to check out this paper from Santa Clara Valley. Dr. Pashpanoika, thank you for your time today.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
And that's it for this 40th episode of the RehabCast. Please click like on your podcast app and take a moment to send this show to a friend or colleague. Until next time.